This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, data mining and privacy issues are in the news, but we want to talk about some data that could affect your life in ways you might not have considered. We're talking about your credit reports, and we'll talk about how errors can appear and cost you plenty and what to do about that. That's coming up later in the program. But first, we want to talk politics because the president is overseas. He's been meeting with the leaders of the world's biggest economies, but problems at home are following him there. And we wanted to talk more about that with Lynn Sweet. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome back, Lynn. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Ron Elving. He's the Senior Washington Editor at NPR. Ron, welcome back to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Michelle.
So Ron, I'm going to start with you because the latest poll numbers show President Obama's approval rate taking a big hit. According to a CNN poll, only 49% of respondents found President Obama honest and trustworthy. That's compared to just 58% a month ago. And his numbers are way down with voters under 30 and independents. Why is that?
That's because of the news that has affected the president in the minds of voters all across the political spectrum in the last month. You have people on the right very upset about the IRS, maybe still upset about Benghazi, upset about the NSA surveillance. And on the left, you have a number of people who are upset about the NSA surveillance and see other things in the president that they are disturbed about. Plus, there's a sense, I think, in any president's fifth year, in his second term, but particularly in those early months of a new term when everything starts out so high and then rapidly falls into a reality gap and people start to turn against the president.
Just briefly, Ron, before I turn to Lynn, though, it's interesting that recent numbers about the surveillance program in general found that it seemed at the time that a majority of Americans did feel that a level of surveillance, if it was foiling terrorism, was appropriate. Has something changed, or is it that intellectually, yes, it's okay, but I'm still mad at him? I mean, how do those things work together?
Because you're not talking necessarily about all the same people. There's some overlap. There's some Venn diagram there. But at the same time, a certain number of people have been saying consistently that they cannot accept the NSA surveillance. And among those people, and it's in the 40s percentage-wise, it's a substantial fraction of the country that does not feel good about this. And in that group of people, you have many people who are maybe generally speaking more of a left-leaning persuasion, voters for the president 2008, 2012, who are disturbed about this particular thing. And so at this moment, that tends to magnetically pull them away from the president a little bit. They are not the same people who are saying it's fine with them if the NSA does these things.
So, Lynn, you've covered this president for a long time and his administration for a long time. He's not running for anything, but he does have an agenda that he wants to carry forward, which is presumably why he ran for re-election. Is there a sense in this administration that these poll numbers coming down like this, this level of anger, which does kind of cross across different groups and does affect one of his key constituencies, which is his younger voters, is there a feeling that this could jeopardize his ability to move forward with his agenda?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors right now that are jeopardizing it, and the poll is fascinating in that it did find a generation gap because those in the 18 to 29 age group that had given the president a boost now have taken back some of that support. Now, some of it could be that these whole issues of snooping are something that perhaps it just touches a younger generation who lives on social media. This is the world they grew up in. Now, whether or not it translates itself into how Obama works with Congress, I don't think it's an exact translate right now. Maybe Ryan will disagree with me. I think the problems that Obama has in dealing with the Republican House and, you know, getting a supermajority in the Senate are more situational to right now. The problem with maybe losing youth support would be more of a problem if he had to run again. I don't know, since a lot of these voters are Democratic, it may or may not be a lost pressure point on some members of Congress.
Well, just to Lynn's point, for example, asked about handling of the surveillance of U.S. citizens, that only 33% of voters aged 18 to 34 approved of the surveillance technique, 62% disapproved. Ron, what do you think about that? Do you think this could affect the president's ability to get to his long-term agenda? We're particularly interested in immigration, for example, which is in front of the Congress right now. Amendments are being debated.
Lynn is quite right that it is a different political calculus when you turn to Congress, because then it's what the individual members, particularly senators who are running for re-election in 2014, think about their own political prospects. That's the key issue for them. And the president can either appeal to those things or seem tone-deaf to those things, and that will affect how much they're willing to support the immigration plan, the immigration package, the gang of eight, if you will, legislative leaders in both parties have put forward in the Senate. The president is supporting that legislation. But the key thing for most of those senators is, will that legislation help me and my party in the long run? Is it the right thing to do? Not so much whether or not it's what Barack Obama wants them to do. And yes, it does have an effect, even though he's not going to face the voters again personally. It has an effect on him if his numbers fall this badly and don't recover, because it is a cut into his influence with Congress and with everyone else in the world. Right now, he's a G8. He's meeting with these world leaders. They follow each other's polls obsessively. They know who's up, they know who's down, and it affects whom they listen to.
I was going to ask you about that. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with two of our trusted political observers. Ron Elving is senior Washington editor here at NPR. Lynn Sweet is the Chicago Sun-Times Washington bureau chief. Ron, just pick up that thread for a minute. I was going to ask you about that. The president's overseas right now, traveling to Northern Ireland and Germany. Do you think, are his approval ratings affecting his influence over there? I mean, we note that Syria is on the table, for example. People are very concerned about that. They just issued a tepid statement that they all agree they want to stop the bloodshed. It doesn't seem to represent any advance in terms of actual policy or strategy. Lynn, do you want to take that? Sure, please do.
I would love to, because I was in Berlin with Obama in 2008, and obviously I'm not with him on this trip, and he's speaking tomorrow at the Brandenburg Gate, and in 2008, in the midst of the campaign, he got 200,000 giddy Germans flocked to hear him speak. You may or may not recall, or your listeners may recall, that prompted John McCain at that point to issue a mocking ad as if he were Obama the Messiah. Well, he comes to Europe now a different man. The 4 years that he has been president has shown the world whatever you thought he was. It was a political Rorschach. I think we always knew that. You have the snooping stories that have come out. Guantanamo is still open. There are drones, which is something that is a very sensitive issue outside of the United States. It may not be as big. It's not an everyday issue for a lot of people, but it is in other areas of the world. I think all this has taken, maybe it just brought him down to earth, and people might have had unrealistic expectations, but I'll sure be looking tomorrow to see what kind of crowd is there. Interesting, back in 2008, Chancellor Merkel was not enthusiastic about Obama speaking at the Brandenburg Gate, this very important historic place in Germany. Now, as the president, of course, he gets that position.
Ron, what do you think?
I think back in 2008, a lot of Germans and a lot of Europeans and a lot of people all around the world looked at Barack Obama as a completely different kind of American politician. And they dreamed that somebody like him could become president of the United States. And they imagined that if he were to become president, everything would be different. He would run the country in a totally different way. And the United States would no longer behave the way it had since World War II, or in many instances since World War II. It would be a new day. The Nobel Prize Committee saw so much promise in him as a candidate, they basically gave him the Nobel Prize for his promise as a candidate. Well, now he's in his fifth year of actually being the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces, and he is cast in an entirely different light as the enforcer of American foreign policy desires and wills. And that is not so popular.
What about, though, the fact that, for example, it's been reported that senior administration officials say the Taliban is now opening offices in Qatar and that they are actually going to have talks with them. I mean, isn't that the kind of break in past postures by U.S. presidents? Or do these kinds of, clearly none of us speaks for the administration, but don't these kinds of moves mean anything? Or is it just kind of the meta story, the headlines overwhelms these kinds of initiatives?
Well, there's a lot of things going on at once in a complicated world, I think, is part of the story. And what Ron said, I want to underscore about how Europeans thought things would be different, these might be Europeans who had some vaguely anti-American sentiments coming in to the Obama administration, stemming a lot from the Iraq War, which you give Obama credit for. He wound down wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, still, isn't it funny? I think it's interesting, Michelle and Ron, just being a good U.S. president, dealing with wars, being just in the mode of U.S. presidents, wasn't what Europe wanted. They had a different idea, and oh my God, it turned out that Obama is a conventional president in how he approaches a lot of his foreign policy.
A point he made in his Nobel address, where he made it very clear that he is not a pacifist, certainly not in the way it's understood in Europe. Ron, a final thought from you. I mean, are these, you've been covering presidents for a long time, and you've seen these kinds of ebbs and flows. I mean, President Clinton had some very difficult days in his administration in the second term and ended in on a note of triumph and not loved by everyone, but certainly loved by enough. Do you foresee that ahead?
Year 5 and year 6 are usually pretty tough years. Richard Nixon, back in his day, have wound up, almost impeached and resigning to avoid being impeached. Bill Clinton had tough years. George W. Bush, very tough years in his 5th and 6th years, really reached the point of being almost a defeated president while still in office, lost control of the House and Senate in his midterm election. This is not an unusual pattern. It's something we've seen before. It's how you deal with it and how you try to make it back. That's what makes the second term.
Ron Elving is NPR senior Washington editor. He was kind enough to join us from our studios here in Washington, D.C. Lynn Sweet is the Washington bureau chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. We caught up with her in her office. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, school's out for the summer, but a new report gives most teacher training programs a failing grade. We'll talk about the report and what needs to change to get educators and their students to improve. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. If you are a parent, you might be breathing a sigh of relief or already tearing your hair out trying to find things for the kids to do. Yes, it's that time. It's summer. One thing you'll probably want them to do, though, is keep reading. So our Moms Roundtable will pass on some of their tried and true methods for getting even reluctant readers to keep reading through the summer. That's coming up later in the program. But first, though, we want to take a look at a new study that raises some tough questions about what's happening in classrooms the rest of the year. It's actually about the quality of instruction their teachers are getting. The report claims that most teachers are not entering their first years prepared to actually function in the classroom. That study was released today by U.S. News and World Report and the National Council on Teacher Quality. That's an education research group that advocates for school reform. Here to tell us more about it is Stephanie Banchero. She's the National Education Reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and she dug into the study. Stephanie, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
The report puts it pretty bluntly. It says that most U.S. colleges of education are, quote, an industry of mediocrity, that first-year teachers who enter the classroom are, quote, inadequate to thrive in classrooms with ever-increasing ethnic, socioeconomic student diversity. Why do they say that? Is this mainly a lack of academic preparation, or is it mainly a lack of preparation for the social issues they're going to confront?
Well, it's actually pretty broad. I mean, it's a pretty scathing report on colleges of education, and it, from sort of soups to nuts, it says they're not doing a very good job. They're saying they're not preparing teachers to teach the content, so they don't know how to teach math. They especially don't know how to teach reading. They're not prepared to teach, you know, diverse learners, so they don't know how to teach kids where English is their second language. But also, they just don't know enough about classroom management and how to deal with behavior issues in the classroom.
Now there were criticisms of the methodology, and we could, you know, obviously get lost in that, but you've looked into this. Do you think those criticisms are valid? Like, for example, there are a number of colleges that didn't participate, wouldn't share their syllabi, for example, so that limited the number of schools that the council could rank to fewer than half the roughly 1,450 institutions of higher education with teacher training programs. But even all that aside, what are some of the criticisms, and do you find them valid?
Yeah, so, I mean, just one note, any sort of education research that comes out, there's going to be somebody on the other side attacking it. So that's pretty standard practice in education. The criticisms are basically, the way these folks rated these programs is they looked at a lot of paperwork. So they looked at all the syllabi. They looked at the textbooks. They, you know, it was basically done by analyzing paperwork. They didn't actually go into the classrooms and sit through colleges of education classrooms. So what the colleges of education are saying is, you know, this would be similar to ranking restaurants by looking at the menu. So you don't actually go taste the food. You just look at the menu. I think there's a little bit of validity to that. But on the other hand, I think it's probably not realistic that they could go sit in every college of education, every classroom. I mean, that's sort of an unrealistic expectation. I think a more valid criticism might be that they didn't look at the outcome. So you're only looking at sort of what you're doing in the classroom to prepare this teacher. You're not looking at how that teacher then goes out and does in his or her classroom. I think that's valid. The problem is it's very difficult to measure that, and they're trying to measure it. They just don't have the data yet to do it.
But based on what's in the reporting, what they did take a look at, did they have a theory about why things got to the point where they say that the mediocrity is the norm, that what teachers are as a norm being taught isn't particularly useful? Any thoughts about, you know, why that is? And I'm also, of course, very interested in what the teachers you talk to say about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what they would say is generally this. I mean, if you look at colleges of education and how they're preparing teachers, and this is sort of a sweeping generalization because obviously there's the colleges that don't follow this methodology, but that they haven't changed much in the last, say, 50 years. They basically do things the same way they've done them for 50 years. Obviously, there's some outliers there. And if you look at the classrooms of today, they're far different than they were 50 years ago. We have way more kids in poverty. We have many students where English is their second language. I mean, the classroom just looks completely different. Also, there's just, you know, technology. Are we training them properly to teach technology in the classroom? So I think the overall general criticism is that they just haven't kept up with the times. They haven't changed as quickly as our K-12 classrooms are changing. So therefore, they're not prepared for what they're facing.
What did some of the teachers you talked to say about this? I mean, did they find merit in some of these findings? Did any of the teachers you talked to say, yeah, that's right, I wasn't prepared to teach?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been covering education for 20 years, and universally, every first-year teacher I think I've ever spoken to says they're not prepared. Now, I mean, you know, as a first-year journalist, I think I could probably say the same thing. I'm not sure I was prepared my first day on the job. So there's no doubt that these teachers feel like they're not completely prepared. Now, I mean, I guess the question would be, whose fault is that? But universally, they're not prepared. And I think the biggest complaint that teachers have, and that this report sort of highlighted, is that there's not enough hands-on experience. So, like, if you look at, say, how we prepare doctors, they have a medical residency. So before they become full-fledged doctors, they sort of have the year, I think it's a year or 2 years, where they're residents. They're not full-fledged doctors. They have somebody there sort of holding their hand. And what teachers will say, first-year teachers will say, look, we need more of that. We need more time in the classroom actually seeing how it works before we're just sort of unleashed into the classroom to do things. And, you know, remember, a lot of first-year teachers end up in, you know, sort of the hardest classrooms. I mean, urban school districts that have, you know, hard-to-staff classrooms often will fill them with, you know, new young teachers. So that's a big disconnect.
We're talking with Stephanie Banchero. She's national education reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about a new report that suggests that most teacher education programs are lacking and they do not prepare first-year teachers to actually run a classroom. We're talking about that. You know, you can see the other side of that, too, though. I mean, you can see where a lot of parents might be saying, I do not want you experimenting with my child. I do not want you learning on the job. I kind of want you to be ready,
ready to go.
Well, does the report suggest any option here? Is the suggestion that perhaps a residency type arrangement or a fellows program or something like that should be the norm, where you work basically as an apprentice for a period of time under the supervision of a senior teacher or a more experienced teacher until you learn the ropes, and then you become a fully prepared? Or are there arguments that the instruction is just so lacking, we just need to scrap the whole system and start over?
Yeah, so let me answer the first part there, and then I'll go back to sort of the instruction. I mean, in the field itself, colleges of education, many colleges of education are saying, look, we need to revamp ourselves. And many of them are adopting this sort of residency idea. There's a program here in Chicago called the Academy for School Leadership, where they take young teachers, first-year teachers, they put them in the classroom with another teacher, sort of a master teacher, and they spend their whole year just watching that master teacher work, and then they also, you know, teach classes over time. So that model seems to work quite well. Now, it's costly because you've got two teachers in the classroom, so there's the problem there. But, I mean, it's not really experimenting because there's another master teacher in the classroom. And there are some colleges of education that are saying, yeah, you know what, we need to give them more hands-on experience. Because typically how it works now is you don't get your so-called student teaching experience until you're just about ready to graduate from college, and it's in the spring, and it's like 10 weeks. Well, that's not really enough time to sort of figure out how to get a classroom under control. And that's really the hardest thing for first year teachers. You walk in the door and you don't know how to, you know how to take attendance, but you don't know how to get kids in line, or you don't know how to, you know, differentiate the kid that's reading at a third grade level and there's a kid that's reading at a sixth grade level. How do you deal with that?
So maybe not keep the kids in line, maybe keep the kids inspired. Maybe we could put it that way.
Exactly.
Before we let you go, though, we have about a minute and a half left. Were there programs that got it right? Were there programs that could be role models for other programs that the survey could point to?
Yeah, well, funny, there aren't that many. They rated it on 0 to 4 stars, and there were only 4 programs that got 4 stars. Generally, high school programs that train high school teachers got more stars, and that's generally because to be a high school teacher, oftentimes you need more content. You need to know more about math. You need to know more about science. So one thing they say, look, you really need to know math before you go out and teach math. So, you know, the programs that are basically giving you more content knowledge did better.
But the lower school, elementary school programs, just not very highly regarded.
Yeah, because, you know, in elementary school, it's sort of more a generalist. You have to, you know, they teach math, reading, science, they teach everything. So it's more a generalist training, and you're not, you know, you don't have a specific training in math, for example.
Stephanie, what else we've mentioned that you've been covering this for a long time. I'd love to hear your impressions of this. Were you surprised by this? What did you find most compelling in this report?
This has been debated for a couple of years, and even Arne Duncan and Obama have sort of pressed colleges of education to sort of, you know, transform and do things better. So I wasn't surprised by too much of it, except for I was actually surprised by how many there were 160 schools that are programs that got 0 stars, basically saying there's a consumer alert, don't go here. I was surprised by that so many, I mean, the average number of stars was somewhere between 1 and 2, and I guess I was surprised by how low they were rated. I thought there'd be more that got higher ratings. I mean, there's several highly regarded programs out there. University of Michigan, for example, only got 2 to 2.5 stars, and it's a really great program, very highly regarded.
Maybe there's more to look at there. That was Stephanie Banchero. She's the National Education Reporter for the Wall Street Journal. We caught up with her in Chicago. Stephanie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle.
We're going to switch gears now and talk about matters of personal finance. A recent report from the Federal Trade Commission found that 1 in 4 consumers had errors in their credit reports. And that might seem like a minor inconvenience until you need to take out a loan or get a mortgage, when it could become a major headache. So we thought this would be a good time to talk with one of our regular money coaches about this and what to do about this. Luis Barajas is an author and personal finance counselor. He's welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. How have you been?
Good. Now, before we get started, let's make sure we have our terms right. What's the difference between a credit report and a credit score?
Well, very different things. I mean, basically what happens is that creditors, like, for example, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, what they do is they will send information to the credit agencies, and the credit agencies will then put together, based on your credit and what you've done and how you've paid your bills, will create a score for you. So they're two separate things.
Now, I'm sure that others have had this situation. you get a call from, say, an agency demanding that you pay a phone bill, and you say, well, what are you talking about? I'm talking to you, so obviously my bill is paid. And then you dig deeper and find out that it's for a cell phone account, say, in Texas, where you don't live, okay? Which may be how most people find out about these things. What should happen then? I mean, what is the consequence of that? Because most people might say, well, I've cleared that up. I've explained that that's not me. Ignore it. Bad idea? Good idea?
Well, no, first of all, that's exactly what has happened to me. It happened to me, even though I'm a financial advisor. I had the exact same thing happen. It happens to at least, you know, tons of people a year. I think the FTC says, the Federal Trade Commission says, that we have over 10 million victims a year. And so what you have to do is take care of that immediately. And there's really technically four things that you have to do. And so do you want me to go through those four things?
Yes, please. Let's find out.
Okay, so the first thing is you've got to alert your credit issuers and tell your bank immediately. So the problem is that most people, if they'll steal their wallet, they'll steal their credit cards, and you don't have that information. But that information technically is in the back of a credit card, for example. And so what happens, and they'll use that credit card to go get a phone and then put the bill on there. That's what happens. So one of the things you should do when you have, especially now or today, turn over the credit cards, write them down on a separate piece of paper, put them somewhere safely, and just in case that your wallet is stolen and you have to call the credit card company so they can close those credit cards immediately, and then they'll open up new ones for you.
Well, one of the things you were telling us about is that a lot of times people pay their bills by maybe putting the bill in their mailbox and letting the mail carrier pick it up. And you're saying, you know, bad idea that people sometimes steal those bills to get that personal information.
So. Yeah, it happens more than you think. And what happens is there are people out there who are just waiting for people to put their bills in their mailboxes, and somebody comes up and pulls them out and opens them up, and they've got all your information. And they've got not only that, but if you're paying by check these days, they've got your bank routing number, they've got your bank account number, they've got your name. All they need to do is somehow figure out how to take your social security number.
One of the things you were also telling us is that it's very important to check your credit reports annually. At least
absolutely,
annually.
Absolutely.
How do you do that?
Yeah, and most people don't even know that they can get that free.
How do you do that?
Okay, well, what you should do is go to www.annualcreditreport.com, and you can actually get a credit report for each of the three major credit agencies, which is Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. And you can review your credit report and take a look at it and see if there's anything on there that looks suspicious or doesn't look right. Or maybe one of the credit card companies reported something wrong, or maybe a mortgage company reported something that was late that really wasn't late. And you can catch that and you can fix that.
And fix that how? Like, what do you do? I mean, I think a lot of people talk about just the nightmare of having to spend hours writing letters. Is it that hard? Is it that bad?
It can be bad, and again, if it's just fixing a mistake, it's not a big deal. But if it's something where it's been identity fraud, it can actually take a long time, but you have to keep at it, because what's going to happen is if it's wrong, it's going to affect your credit score. And remember, your credit score is going to affect the potential for you when you're going out and get a new home loan or refinancing your mortgage or buying a car. It affects all of that. So you have to stay on top of it. But what you should do, if somebody's actually stolen your credit, you should also file a police report, Michelle. You have to go to the local authorities, file a police report, and then get a copy of that report and send it to the creditors and the credit agencies.
How would you know, though, if your identity has been stolen? I mean, for example, I had the experience once of going on a business trip. The one place I used my credit card was the hotel to check in, because everything else was kind of covered. I was at a conference. And then 2 months later, I find out that somebody has used my number to buy camera equipment in that same city where I had not been since. I'm like, that's the only way I found out. How would
right.
you find
well,
out?
Well, you know, it's being very vigilant and monitoring your credit card statements, your bank account statements. I mean, that's how you're going to find out immediately. What most people do when they catch it right away is that they've got online banking, or they're actually taking a look at their credit card bills through online, and they don't have to wait an entire month. Because what will happen is, let's say that I take your identity and go out and buy a computer with your information. And if you're not going to take a look at your monthly statement till maybe about a couple weeks after it gets there, it's already been 6 weeks.
So stay on it. Got it. Do not ignore it. Luis Barajas was with us from Irvine, California. Luis, thanks so much for joining us.
Michelle, thank you always.
Just ahead, we talk with our Moms Roundtable about how to keep kids reading this summer. One way might be to find books that talk back.
Niños y niñas, aplaudan a Tito Puente.
Before he could walk, Tito was making music. He banged spoons and forks on pots and pans, windowsills and cans.
It's a new digital multicultural world for children's and young adult literature. We'll take you there. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, we want to get some advice about something you've probably been thinking about. If you have school-aged children, you've probably gotten the message that you need to keep their heads in the academic game somehow over the summer, especially reading. And this may conflict with your children's plans, which may run more toward playing video games and seeing how many bags of chips they can eat in a day. Well, we can't help you with the chips, but our panel today have spent a lot of time thinking about keeping kids excited about reading, even reluctant readers, even in the summer. So with us now are Lorene Roy. She's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Information. She's also past president of the American Library Association and a mom of one. Monica Oliveira is co-founder of Latinas for Latino Literature, a freelance writer, also a mom of two. And Marjan Guerra is mom of two and founder of the online book club for kids, Biblionasium. It allows children to share and rate books that they have read. Welcome to you all. Welcome back, I should say. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michelle.
Lorene, let me start with you. Why should reading be a big part of summer?
Well, you don't want to head into the area of what we call the summer slide. You want your kids to be ready for school in the fall. You want them on reading and above reading track. And you want to be working with your public library and involved with their summer reading programs.
So, Monica, you write about education. Talk a little bit more about this, the summer brain drain or summer slump. Is that so terrible?
Well, actually, yes, because during the summer months, a lot of times children can lose up to 3 months of learning. And so then when they start back to school in the fall, a lot of times they have lost a lot of the concepts or the skills that they learned towards the end of the previous school year. So teachers have to spend time covering that material over again so that everyone can be caught up.
So Marjan, why don't we start with you on the question of how to get kids excited about reading. One of the things that you were telling us is that books are like shoes. You can't just go by what's on the label saying this is for this child's reading group. They're like shoes. You've got to look for the right fit. Will you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Actually, this came from my own personal experience when my second grade son picked up Harry Potter, and I was this very proud parent who had a eighth grader reading a 400-page book. He made it through the first one, and he started the second one, and he never finished. And at the time, I told my husband he must be the only kid in America who doesn't like Harry Potter. And it was only after we started this project is we realized that there's actually the concept of reading levels and finding the right fit for your reading ability makes a big difference in the way children experience books. So the metaphor of using the books are like shoes is because when you go buy a pair of sneakers, you don't walk in and say, I want a pair of sneakers for a second grader. You have to have their feet measured, and then based on that measurement, you find the right sneaker. So it's the same concept with books, and I think this was something as a parent that had escaped me during all the time that I was looking for books for my kids to read.
Well, Lorene, this might be where you were talking about how it's really important to work with your librarians on this. Tell us more about that. How can a librarian help you find that right fit?
Well, let's start with summer reading programs. They've been taking place in public libraries for the last 100 years, and there's evidence of the impact of summer reading programs on preventing that reading slide over the summer, but really helping kids get ready for the school year. And there's also evidence from studies that say parents actually read more. Kids have more books in the home. There's more conversation about reading. And you can rely and work with your public librarian during the summer and also with your school librarian. You want to be in a school and you want to advocate for having a certified school librarian who'll be working with the teachers, with the kids, and with the parents year-round.
Well, what do you mean by working with? Give me an example of what you should do. Maybe some schools are not as proactive about this as others. I mean, some schools are sending reading lists home with the kids in their backpacks, and some schools are actually saying, you know, I want to see this, you know, when you come back in the fall, I want to see this filled out, or I want to see letters. And other schools aren't doing any of that. So how should you work with somebody, or what should you be looking for?
Well, I was at the Pueblo Laguna in New Mexico just last week, and there, as they were planning and working with their children for summer reading, and the kids were engaged with art examples. They were watching film, too. They were reading. They were counting their minutes reading. They were getting incentives. And the kids were so excited. And by working with that librarian, it means bringing your kids to the site. It means working with them, developing that reading list with the librarian, if that's what you want to do, suggesting other topics, and being a reader in the home. You know, the best role models for reading are the parents. So being able to read or listening to audiobooks in the car, so the kids know that reading is a part of every moment and a part of everyday life.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about how to keep your kids reading over the summer. We're talking with three moms who thought a lot about this. Marjan Guerra of Biblionasium.com, Monica Oliveira of Latinas for Latino Literature, and Lorene Roy. She's a professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and former president of the American Library Association. So Marjan, talk a little bit more about your site. How does that work?
Well, Biblionasium, we use the metaphor of gymnasium because we believe that just like in sports, you need discipline, you need practice, you need to set goals, and then you will see the results and the rewards. And it's the same thing with reading. So these principles are built into the features that we have on the site. The site itself connects children to the three constituents that most influence what they read, and that's their friends and their librarians and the teachers and the parents. And it's a really social community where they can share and exchange book recommendations and talk about books and what they like. We also provide,
obviously, with parental permission.
Of course, right? Yes, uh-huh. Absolutely. We are targeted towards elementary and middle school children. So our site is COPPA compliant, which is Children's Online Privacy Protection Act regulations.
Okay. And what do kids like about it? Let's talk about the fun part, you know. How does it make it more fun?
Well, you know, this generation is growing up digital, and they like to be online. They like to socialize online. They like to have a digital presence online. And what we do is they personalize their experience. There's animated avatars. They set up virtual bookshelves where they can track and catalog what they're reading, what they like to read, and it's social. So you can see what your friends are reading, if you can recommend books to your friends, and of course we have rewards built into there. So we are a bibliognasium, so we give out trophies and awards for completing reading challenges. So we work on it on all levels. It's social and it's personalized.
Lorene, talk a little bit, if you would, about the role of choice. I mean, know that how much choice do you think kids should have about what they pick up to read in the summer? I know for myself, during the rest of the year, I'm very much driven by work. And in the summer, I kind of just want to read garbage, if I can put it like that. And I'm just wondering, Lorene, if you feel that kids should get the same privilege. Should they just be able to pick up whatever they want to read as long as it's not, say, a girly magazine?
Well, I think that's what we advocate for. At all levels, librarians support people's right to read, and that extends to the earliest readers. And I remember the day when I quit buying the books that I wanted my son to read because he was showing me what he preferred. And I supported because he reads. You know, I don't read science fiction and fantasy as much as he does, and I learned through him. And so you support your kids in many ways, and that reading preference is a way for them to be independent and also for them to start to really enjoy reading, make their own selections.
Monica, what do you think about that? The idea of you know, obviously a lot of parents are interested in directing or being involved in what their kids read. They want them to read about maybe figures that are part of their heritage, or they want to learn more about their heritage, but maybe their kids just want to read fantasy or something like that. Where are you on this whole question of how much choice to give your children in choosing what to read?
You know, I really think it's a balance of things. I think kids definitely, in order to be inspired and motivated to read, they need to be able to choose the books and the topics that they want. But I think that can be balanced out, and parents should also play a hand and make selections and offer them as well different types of books, because a lot of times kids might not know that they would love a certain book just because they haven't read it before, but once they start reading it, they might find that they really, really absolutely love it. So I think it's a blend of both, definitely.
Where are you, Monica, on this whole question of offering incentives or prizes? I know that's another thing that's somewhat controversial. I mean, I know people do use these incentives, like in schools they use them, even say if you read X number of books, then, you know, we'll have a pizza party or something like that. Do you do that, Monica? What do you think about that idea?
Yes, I actually do. I do think that kids need to be motivated and inspired a lot of times and rewarded for their hard work. I know that with my kids, they're more likely to pick up a book and read if they know that, for example, when we go to the library, they're going to get more tickets. And then at the end of the summer, they can turn those tickets in for some sort of prize, like via a new book or a new toy. I think those are powerful motivators, and we need to keep those in mind.
Lorraine, talk a little bit, if you would, too, about these summer reading programs. How do they work? And if your community isn't already starting one, what would you recommend?
Well,
I was asking Lorraine about... I'm sorry, let me get Lorraine on this, and then we'll go to the other moms. Okay.
Sure. A lot of summer reading programs are organized through public libraries within a region or a state, often according to a theme. For example, I mentioned being at the Pueblo of Laguna Public Library last week. And their theme this summer is Dig Into Reading. And there's an event every day, story and reading time, arts and crafts, gaming day, arts and crafts again, movie day, but all also related to books and reading, where the kids can come and have activities. They often get reading logs, or they record minutes of reading or titles. They might record minutes doing other things where they're helping others. So in many ways, it's developing a reading community, extending it through the summer, and working in a, you know, the safe, protected, reliable, and loved place. That's the library.
Martin, what did you want to say?
I was going to comment on the incentive portion is that on our site, actually, parents can set up a reading challenge for their kids. And we offer some suggestions like a child's favorite dinner, maybe two nights in a row, maybe an extra 20 minutes of sleep on a Saturday. So you don't have to really give yourself and your child an iPhone to incentivize them to read. It could be something as simple as their favorite meal two nights in a row. And really nobody knows how to better incentivize a child better than a parent. So that's what we also provide through our platform, is for parents to engage their kids on that digital platform and kind of agree to some kind of reward for the reading.
I thought there were a trip to the amusement park might be in there somewhere, wouldn't it? I would think that would go over rather well. Another book? I don't know. Monica, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to mention that a lot of times finding those cultural books and starting a book program like we did, which this is the first year or first summer that we've actually launched an online summer reading program specifically for Latino families, and there hasn't been anything like that online before. Many of the programs offer some Spanish aspects to it, but ours is specifically geared for Latino families, and that includes the reading lists, which are all full of solely of Latino children's literature, which is something that I think a lot of kids really need to see their own faces reflected in the books they read, and sometimes parents just don't know where to find those. So that was one of the biggest projects that we've done this summer, and we've seen such a tremendous response. We already have over 400 families signed up, and that's just been in 2 weeks. So we have to consider a person's heritage and culture, the children, to help them be excited about learning and reading about other kids just like themselves.
I was going to ask Lorraine about that, because I know you've done research in this area, and also with your work at the American Library Association. Have you observed that to be true, that the kids, and you were also Native American, Lorraine, I think wanted to mention that as well, and there hasn't always been a lot of literature available featuring people from the different tribes and their heritage and so forth. Have you found that to be true in your experience, Lorraine, that if kids are exposed to literature that maybe speaks to their heritage, that they might get more excited, or does it matter?
It really matters in many ways in terms of children seeing someone like themselves, seeing someone who is enjoying all aspects of life, seeing people who are recognized and honored for their backgrounds and the children having similar backgrounds. We're very fortunate within Library Land that there are also ethnic library associations that are affiliated with the American Library Association. For example, the American Indian Library Association, and they also have youth media awards and youth literature awards. So you can look online and see these are the books that librarians with those backgrounds, with those interests, recommend also to parents and to children.
Okay, now before we let you go, thank you for all these great suggestions for the kids. Now I'm really going to put you all on the spot and ask you, what are you all reading this summer? Lorraine, I'll start with you.
Well, I just finished Nia Vardalos's Instant Mom, and if you know Nia, she was the woman whose movie is My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and it was fun, but also a great read about foster parenting. And then I'm starting Housemaid of Dawn, which I read many years ago, and Scott Momaday, whom I met last week, and kind of revisiting that book as well.
Okay. Monica, what are you reading this summer?
This summer I have a list of Latino authors that I'm trying to get into. I've just picked up a new one by, I'm having a momentary.
Oh, don't even tell me it's Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Okay, don't even try to tell me that it's all like Nobel Prize winners. Don't even pretend like that. You know, you want to read something, some romance or something. Come on.
Right. Well, I'm reading lots of different things, like Garrison Keillor. I just picked up Garrison Keillor to read this summer because I read that with my kids, and they love to listen to him on the radio, so I like to pick up his book, Lake Wobegon Days, which is one of the ones I've read. And I spend a lot of time reading to my kids, so I read that. I read every day, usually at bedtime. We pick up a book, we read Little House on the Prairie, or we read Garrison Keillor. We have started Harry Potter, so just lots of different authors.
Martin, what are you reading this summer?
I'm looking forward to reading Contagious by Jonah Berger. It's about how things go viral.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that sounds very interesting. Yeah. Monica, the Garrison Keillor one, I hope that's like really true and you're not just like making up to us, right?
You
know,
oh, no.
You're not just telling us that to, you know, get on our good
oh,
side,
no.
right? Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot PBS. I mean, okay. NPR, yes. That's right.
Monica Olivera is co-founder of Latinas for Latino Literature. She's a mom of two. We caught her on the line from Scotland Neck, North Carolina. Marjan Guerra is a mom of two and the founder of Biblionasium. That's an online book club for kids. We caught up with her at NPR New York. Lorraine Roy is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, the School of Information there. She's a mom of one, and she joined us from member station KUT in Austin. Thank you all so much. Happy reading, everybody.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.